Good morning and welcome to the July 10th, 2023 meeting of the Chelan Public Utilities Commission. All five commissioners are present today, and as staffing the meeting today is our manager Kirk Hudson, our clerk of the board Rebecca Newman, and standing in for Eric Walquist is Katie Yount as legal counsel today. Happy to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It is good to be here. It's a great day in July. I hope everybody had a good 4th of July. I know I did. So I would ask all of you to check your electronic devices and make sure that they're placed in the silent mode to assist in not disrupting in today's meeting. We do value public input at our meetings, and we'll be providing an opportunity for the public to have input at the end of our morning session. And if we're fortunate today, we may wrap everything up in the morning, but we'll see as we go. If you wish to speak, we ask that you would provide your name and address for the record as our meetings are recorded, and we wish to have an accurate record of your input. We additionally ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes. Additionally, if you wish to speak to any of the agenda items today, I'll provide that opportunity at the end of each segment. Our flag salute and safety minute will be brought to us today by Eddie Amezcua. Did I get it right, Eddie? Good, super.
To the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
You have to put the microphone really close to your mouth.
Or the handheld mic.
I'll just sit.
Yeah, put the microphone really close to your mouth. Yeah.
Okay. How's it going, everybody?
Good.
Oh, and I literally have to speak right here?
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm Eddie Amezcua. I'm the site safety coordinator at Rocky Reach Dam. Started with the district about 2 months ago, so I'm fairly new. But happy to be here. It's a great place to work, and I'm excited to join the team with the safety team. And for this month, we'll talk about water safety. It's that time of year. You know, everybody's out and about. You got, you know, everybody's boating out in the lakes, rivers, whatnot, with the family, with the kids. So I thought it'd be a good topic to cover. So boating, just a couple bullets here. You know, so children should wear life jackets at all times when on boats, docks, bodies of water. Just, you know, probably I got a little 5-year-old. He doesn't know how to swim, so every time we're on the water, we have a life jacket on him. Just to make sure, you know, the kids are taking safety precautions. Adults and kids should be warned of dangers of boating, even as a passenger when under the influence of drugs or alcohol. So, you know, if someone's boating on a jet ski, if you're under the influence of something, right, you're putting yourself at danger, you're putting other people on the water at danger. So it's just, you know, if possible, it'll be drinking and driving when on the water as well. And again, account for all passengers before starting the engine and wear your emergency cutoff switch, at all times, especially if you're on a jet ski, right? That switch, if you have it on, obviously if you fall off the jet ski shuts off, and then, you know, you're not putting yourself at danger then. Just a couple things about open water swimming. If possible, don't swim alone. I know, you know, there's some people that like to swim by themselves, but if, you know, if you are going that route, maybe let somebody know, hey, I'm going to be at this place at this time in case something does happen. Currents and rivers and creeks can be fast moving and unpredictable. A couple weeks ago, there was, I think, a drowning here down at Crescent Bar. So, you know, when people are going into the river, you know, just be careful. You know, we don't know exactly what's under the water, where are we jumping to, if there's rocks or how fast the current's going, how cold the water is. So just a couple things to keep in mind when going into open water. Again, keep within your fitness and swimming capabilities. You know, don't feel pressured if you're out with friends or whatnot. People are swimming out. If you're not a good swimmer, then maybe don't go out and swimming into, you know, deep water if you're not comfortable. And again, when it comes to kids, just keeping a close eye on kids. We all know whoever has kids, they tend to not pay attention. And if, you know, if we're not paying attention to the kids, if we're on a dock or whatnot, they could jump off into the water if we're not paying attention. And then my last slide, just CPR. 33 drownings do occur each day, a third which can be fatal. So that's pretty big number right there. If performed immediately, it could double or triple a victim's chance of survival if you do know CPR. And then the last thing I know not all of us probably have taken a CPR class or whatnot, but the American Heart Association does have a one-minute video on how to perform CPR, and I think it's a pretty good thing to know, or at least take a look at it right now for the summer months in case, you know, if you are in a situation where you might need to perform CPR if someone needs help. But that's all I had. Any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
I don't have a question, but just a comment. Yeah. I find this very timely.
Yeah.
So you may not know, but I'm from the Chelan area, and Kirk had the good fortune of receiving a picture from me this last week as parents who were very present were observing their children jumping from the bridge into the river, but even taking it one step further, they had attached a slack line to the PUD dock from there to the city bridge, and the kids were having fun playing on that slack line, and the parents were just rooting them on and taking pictures. Not one thing could have gone wrong there at all. But so I appreciate the timeliness of this.
Okay, thank you.
The slack line was removed, by the way.
So, Eddie, I also want to thank you for your timeliness, and it brought back memory of 2 years ago, a young mother in our Rotary Club came to a Rotary meeting to share that the day before she had had to rescue her child out of the swimming pool and perform CPR. The child was unresponsive. So the CPR, watchfulness, all of those are words very near and dear. Thank you.
No, thank you. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Eddie.
Thanks for taking your hat off during the play.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, commissioners, the approval of the agenda. Management has recommended that we move resolutions 8, 9, and 10 to the consent agenda. Is there any objection? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to, well, I would don't need a motion on that one. If you don't have objection, the consent agenda will be approved as amended once we get there. But so anyway, we're good.
Okay, next item.
CPO.
Yeah, I'd like to invite Malia Mayer up. Welcome, Malia. Malia is one of our employees in the accounting department, and she was nominated for a cycle of personal ownership award, nominated and was actually presented the award for the month. And Malia is responsible for our annual report. And it's quite an undertaking to do the annual report. And Malia does a fantastic job, which is what she's being recognized for. And I have to say, as part of that process, Malia starts early and she gets the people that are involved right up front in terms of the design of the annual report. And then for those that are involved, Malia makes it really easy. She allows them to meet in person or do it by email, whichever works best for each of the people. And I don't know what people choose, but I've done a combination of both, but I really appreciate how you operate in terms of allowing flexibility for what works best for those that are involved. But it's well-organized, well-orchestrated process, and it gets done on time, and it's always a great product, and it's because of the effort that Malia does to lead that effort and coordinate across multiple departments. So congratulations, Malia, and thank you for your job well done.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I've been here at the district for 21 years, all of them in accounting, and I have been on the annual report team for about that long. More recently kind of taken the leadership of coordinating the effort, but I am not responsible for it. There is a large district team that puts it together, and I just make sure they get it on time. So this is what it looks like. I know sometimes you guys use it. Like I said, worked at the district for 21 years. My dad worked for the district. He was a hydro mechanic and a operator maintainer in Lake Chelan. And also my grandpa did too. My mom's dad used to He was the head maintainer at Rock Island and lived in the cottages there when I was growing up. So I'm a legacy PUD employee.
Yeah. Wow. Literally.
I felt like Rudy kind of popped his head right there the moment when the...
Yeah, it moved. Yeah. So I grew up in Chelan, neighbors with Kelly.
Okay. Wow.
Great. Well, thank you, Malia.
Thank you.
And thanks for
Malia. Before you leave, I just want to share. While we haven't had a lot of opportunity to interact over the years, the one thing that I always find with you when I see you, you've always got that smile on your face.
I appreciate that.
And it's it brightens everybody's day when you're smiling like that. It brightens everybody's day. Thank you for that persona.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You bet.
And I also wanted to share that Kelly gave me the copy of the financial report not so long ago, and I was reading through it, and it's really impressive. It takes numbers and makes a story out of them. So many financial reports are not as fun to read, so thank you for making it.
It's not always fun to read.
Okay, well, we're required. We glossed over those.
Thank you.
It was good to see your name, too.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Malia.
Thank you. Okay. Fish and Wildlife.
Next item?
You bet.
Okay. I'd like to invite Kelly Cordell and Lance Keller up for a Fish and Wildlife update. This is one we try and do every 3 or 4 months, and they've got a couple of hot topics to speak about.
Literally.
Yeah.
Good morning, Commissioners. Lance Keller, Senior Fisheries Biologist for the District. Always great to be in front of the board. We've got the quarterly update, as Kirk outlined. We're going to cover some osprey work that Kelly works on, and then we're going to provide a brief update on the 2023 HCP confirmation survival study that was conducted at Rocky Reach this spring. So I'll turn it over to Kelly.
Good morning. My name is Kelly Cordell, and I'm a wildlife biologist here with Chelan PUD. I've been here, since 2004. I worked seasonally for a little while, and it's hard to do the math sometimes. So about 18, almost 19 years now I've been here. Our osprey nest monitoring program that we've been doing since 2006 is actually a component of Chelan PUD's avian protection plan. And it's a plan that we have in place to deal with animal-caused outages and incidences on our utility lines. Since 2006, we've began this osprey nest monitoring, and we've seen a substantial increase in the number of osprey that return to our service area to nest. And with that increase in the population comes an increase in risk. Osprey tend to choose nesting sites that are in open areas, on tall structures, and near water. And they have a propensity to select utility lines for their nesting spots. So that puts us in a little bit of a defensive, and we try to be proactive position in managing osprey nests. Now, osprey are covered under the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And it's not just the bird that's covered, it's also their nest. And so we actually work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under a memorandum of understanding to manage nests. And we also do this in conjunction or in coordination with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Because if we take down a nest, we are required by that MOU to provide an alternate opportunity. So in the springtime, we're very busy going out and conducting our osprey nest monitoring, where we begin in March, and we're looking for areas where we may have a potential problem, where we have a problem cropping up, and where there might be opportunities for us in the future. So in terms of managing our osprey nests, we are busy, and we are out at least once a week looking at these birds from March through the end of August. This is just a little snapshot for us. You see, in 2006, we were monitoring just under 20 osprey nests, and in 2003, we're just under 100. And so it gets to be a lot. There takes two of us to get out there and take a look at them and keep an eye on these birds. So that's a 489% increase for us.
I got a question, please.
Sure.
Yeah, I was back in 2008. I did take a river tour up there, and there was just, you almost count them on your hand how many nests there were in osprey. Mm-hmm. And they were being looked at very closely. I see from there to now, it's been very successful, the program, as far as numbers. Is there a target number or goal that we're shooting for in this, or is it sky's the limit?
We aren't shooting for any population number. We're just responding to the birds that are coming to nest in our area. And so, as you know, osprey a long time ago were affected by the DDT thing with the eggshell thinning, and their populations had really crashed. But mm-hmm. since then, things have improved. Water quality has improved. Their food source have improved, and it's, you know, a testament to how things have gotten better in the environment mm-hmm. as these birds are coming back. But we're just responding to them being in our area,
okay.
kind of like the squirrel thing. So we're not managing for, okay. we're managing with.
Well, I just, you know, at some point, you know, I'm just saying, at some, would they be a nuisance at some point when you start thinking of it? In those
yeah, things? They kind of are.
Well, that's where I'm getting at. That's where I'm getting at. But anyway.
Yes, yes. So, now, they're a wonderful bird. But.
So sort of a follow-up question to that, you sure. know, and I'm getting ahead of your slides because I've gone through them, but the number of nests that are on our power poles, mm-hmm. are we, once they're there, we don't have the ability to remove them, I think.
Well, that's a little bit of a thing. So we do have an ability to move them. Timing is everything for us. And so when we first start seeing sticks being dropped on a pole, some configurations are okay. Like our big H-frame structures that have a lot of spacing are typically okay. Sometimes the nest gets too big and heavy, and it can affect the structure, and then we need to talk about moving it off. But typically we'll let the birds go through their nesting season. And when they leave for South America at the end of September, then we can do some nest management during the wintertime when they're south on their migration. And so we can move things around. We're actually planning on doing some of that this winter on some of the nests. But for distribution structures, we don't want those birds on there. The spacing is too close. It's too risky. They bring a lot of really weird material up there beyond sticks and grass, which I'll talk about here in a second. But our goal is to not have them on distribution at all. And so part of our proactive approach in getting out, driving around, looking at our service area is to identify areas where they're dropping sticks and try to get them moved off. And so you'll see in the purple here is an increase in the amount of nest platforms in our service area. And this is a response to that, is we're trying to move them from a dangerous, risky location into somewhere that's very safe. And we can do that early on in the nest period. Once they have eggs in the nest, then we're kind of stuck. We can't move that. Early on, if it's just sticks, we can move it. But our memorandum of understanding is that we can move a nest when it's just sticks. When it has eggs in it, then we're stuck. So we try to get to it before then so we can move it off and into a safe location. You'll see on this, we've gone to a GIS, a tablet management, and we're working on our data, but I excluded for 2023 not ours, but Douglas County and some of the irrigation district platforms that have been installed. So I just wanted to share that the number of platforms in the area haven't gone down necessarily, but Chelan PUD platforms, we have a total of 56 nest platforms that we've installed that we monitor and maintain. I still monitor everybody else's platforms because how they manage their platforms can affect us, but it's not included in the 2023 data. So this is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about risk, is these sticks that are up on a distribution, and you can see some of the sticks have actually fallen down onto the transformers. We don't want this at all on there. So we try to catch them even before this, when we very first see them flying around with sticks. And so what we'll do is we'll work with other landowners, sometimes it's the county, and maybe we're looking at right away, and we'll actually set up a standalone nest platform that's entirely off of our distribution system and get these birds off of an energized structure and onto somewhere safe. Because we want the osprey to be safe, and we want our lines to be safe. We want to keep the power on. Sometimes these birds, like I said, they will drag weird things. The picture on the right there is actually north of Chelan along Highway 97, and this osprey had chosen a strand of home stereo coax cables, which are pretty conductive, and decided to drop those on the line up there. And it's actually, it did start a fire. Fortunately, it stayed very small. We were able to send our lineups crews and put some insulating material up there on that pole. And we were able to offer a safe alternate location for these birds to nest. And happy to report, they're still nesting in that same nest platform 10 years later. So that's a really good success story, even though it looks like a little bit of a mess there. But like I said, osprey, they're kind of the pack rats of the sky. They bring a lot more than just sticks and grass into their nests. And so it's, of course, something of concern for us, because if they're taking that to an energized structure, there's lots of garbage, and I'm sure you've all seen baling twine hanging off of their nests. This is an osprey nest autopsy. We have the osprey nest down there at the apple yard in South Wenatchee. A couple of years ago, we had a bad winter. Half of it blew down, only half of it. And curiosity got the best of us, and so we went digging through it, and we cataloged some of the junk that the osprey like to bring in there. And so you see the leather gloves was really interesting and kind of a surprise to us. I assume that they were picking those up from the BNSF railroad workers when they were walking away on a break. So I'm not sure what the glove budget is, but you might want to ask them sometime. But the thing to really pay attention to is the items in the red, the electrical wire, aluminum can, and guy wire. These birds will pick up anything and put it into their nest. And those things that are in the red are especially more conductive, and things that we need to be aware of risk-wise that they're putting up there. So just another reason to keep them off of our energized structures. So what does that look like? So we work with all the different agencies in the area and within our own real estate department to identify areas where it's safe, where these birds can nest. And lineups crews will go out and will install an osprey nest platform in an area where it's safe for these birds to travel to and from the water and to stay off of our energized lines. Now, something that we have been struggling with a little bit the last few years is also with the increase in the osprey population, we've had an increase in the Canada goose population, and they've taken a special liking to osprey nests here. They're typically a ground nester, but some of them like the high rise for some reason. And we've come up with a couple different ideas to keep them out. You've probably seen our little UFOs that have been out in late February, early March. We'll actually send the lineups crews out to poles that we deem at risk of occupation by Canada geese. The Canada geese will start nesting in early March, and the osprey haven't returned yet from their South American winter vacation. Osprey typically come back in early April, and so we have a little window of opportunity to prevent the geese from occupying osprey nests. The line crews will go out, and we actually, it's pretty low tech. It's a boat buoy that is inserted into the osprey nest, and then we cover it with a big tarp. And it's tied down pretty good, but that just creates a convex surface where that goose cannot get into the osprey nest and almost sets out a little reserved seating for the osprey. And once we're out, we're conducting our osprey nest monitoring. So we're going out and we're looking and trying to prevent geese from getting in these. And once we see the first osprey return, typically around the first week of April, we call the line crew and they go and take those tarps and buoys off. And then our osprey can come into those platforms and settle in and be good, is what I hope. Something that we only have about 13 of these tarps, and we've deployed all of them, and we're still having goose problems. So one thing that we're working on is coordinating with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife right now for some more tools in the toolbox to prevent these Canada geese from taking up occupancy in osprey nests. So, and with that, I'll open up to any questions.
Commissioner, any questions?
I'm curious if this came about due to the recent fire, or were you already on the agenda?
I was already on the agenda.
Yeah. Like this was for my information only.
It was very timely. Yeah, we had a little incident where an osprey, that one up at Chelan, did have metal and dropped some metal up on that pole. So, yeah.
I had no idea that they were such garbage collectors.
They like the shiny.
Is there a way for our pole operators to just put those bird, you know, those pointy bird?
There's a number of different options, and it depends on the pole configuration, really. The things that we find pretty successful are what we call a shroud. And so it looks like kind of a half pipe of long PVC ripped down lengthwise. And it's just prevents the birds from dropping a stick from above. It just kind of bounces off onto the ground. So that's something that we find effective. They've put plastic owls up there. The triangles really just kind of depend on the configuration, because those are actually meant to occupy space to keep birds from perching in a dangerous spot. Sometimes the triangles actually are a base for nesting material, and so in some applications they don't work very good. So it just really depends on the configuration of the pole. And so each one we look at to see what we can do to prevent the birds from being on there again and to encourage them to go to the nest platforms.
Well, I admire you and your dedication to these little furry things.
They keep us very busy in this.
Commissioner, any other questions, comments?
Yes. I just had one question, Kelly. When the osprey return, do they typically try to come back to their original nesting or nest?
They do. They do. And that's what makes it tough. You know, we spend a lot of time and money and effort accommodating these osprey into a certain spot. And then when a goose comes in, nobody's going to tingle with the goose. And as beautiful and fierce as the osprey look, they're not going to mess with the goose. And so that oftentimes puts us back at square one, because the goose is in their nest. And then they have to go find somewhere alternate, which is typically one of our utility structures. So that's, you know, for us, pretty intensive, trying to keep the geese out so we can accommodate those osprey and not have any problems.
Thank you.
Kelly, you are a marvelous storyteller. I loved your presentation, and you've kept your sense of humor about probably what another person would find as a challenge. What Commissioner Berggren said, you know, the question that keeps emerging to my mind, and I look at the list, you know, when we have 1,000 nests, will that be enough?
I think we have enough.
I wonder, you know, we're prohibited by our agreement from, you know, my thought process would be, you see a nest getting started, maybe you not move the nest, but destroy the nest to force them out of the area. I don't know, but you have a challenge, and I appreciate what you're doing, understanding that I'm a guy that loves to watch osprey fish. You know, so those of us in the county love having the osprey back, but when is enough enough? And that's always a key question.
Yes, yes. I always think about, I went to a presentation a long time ago for Avian Protection Workshop, and there's a gentleman out of Colorado that had spent a lot of time working on osprey, and he reminded everybody that osprey are colonial nesters, and on the coast they can nest very close together, and I don't think we've quite yet hit carrying capacity here.
Oh, wow.
So I just drink my coffee and be ready and feel myself and just try to be aware of what they're doing and where we have opportunities to accommodate them and get them off of our electrical system.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, the geese, as a golfer, when I go to the golf course, one goose is too many, but that's, you know, that's a whole other story. So anyway, great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll turn it over to Lance.
Thank you, Kelly. All right, so for the Rocky Reach Habitat Conservation Plan Project Confirmation Survival Study we conducted in 2023, just a quick reminder on where we've been with the board to date. We brought a resolution for the contract with Blue Leaf Environmental to conduct the survival study for us on October 17th, 2022. We then, after that, started our study design, which pretty much took the contractor as well as district staff the remainder of December 2022 and went into February 2023. We then took that to our external stakeholders that sit on the HCP coordinating committee, and we finally got approval on that on April 7th. We had quite a bit of discussion on that. It was good to see the group engaged on that, but that is a consensus-based group. And we did hear some strong recommendations from that group on how we could improve our study in their eyes. We took that back to our external consultants as well as our internal staff, and we came forward with a study plan that we could all agree upon, and we got that installed on April 7th. Now, that's pretty close to the start of our historical survival studies, about mid-April. So the next bullet there outlines the fact that we were fairly confident that we were going to get approval from that and find some common ground with that group. So we continued to install detection equipment at Rocky Reach, given the fact that we were relying on central maintenance staff and hours, and we were integrated into their work plan. So we kind of had to keep going, but we had pretty high confidence that we were able to get that. So we had all the gear ready to go for the survival study even before we had the study plan approved, which is a bit unusual for us. But once again, some really healthy discussion in that coordinating committee group with the external stakeholders. Briefly, here is an overview of the detection equipment we deployed at Rocky Reach in 2023. Collectively, there's 24 independent deployments of detection equipment that can hear a tagged fish as it approaches and passes Rocky Reach Dam. We had 5 autonomous receivers on the boat restriction buoy line in the forebay. Those receivers are essentially fully contained. They have a battery in it, circuit board, the hydrophone, and that we essentially just hang away from it and deploy it someplace. So we don't have to, we kind of set those and forget those. The green circles on here, those are 12 on-dam deployments, 11 of which we relied on the central maintenance dive crew to install. They were great to work with and supported us and installed those receivers about 23 feet deep below the waterline. Mm-hmm. And the remaining 7 in the forebay were contractor installed. Some of it was autonomous and some of it was actually miniature floating pontoon barges that were able to get the data out in a real-time effort. And I just have this slide here to show that this was a very busy install this year, but we really appreciate the support that we received from Rocky Reach staff, including the central maintenance mechanic, wireman staff, and management as well. Everyone worked together to meet our tight timeline to make sure we were ready to go for a mid-April start. So I'm happy to say that we actually conducted a successful survival study in our eyes. We haven't seen the results yet, and we probably won't for a little while, but we did get meet our tag quotas, got our fish tagged, and got them released into the Rocky Reach project area to evaluate survival. Collectively, we released just over 1,100 tags, with the first release occurring on April 25th and the last release on May 25th, so a full month of collection, transportation, surgical procedures, and releases. We actually had Commissioner Allen come out on the release and got to see some of that stuff below Rocky Reach. That was fun to show that. We did that across 18 different replicates. Looking at the travel time, so we know when we release these fish, we can tell when they're detected on that forebay BRZ line. The average travel time appears to be about 90.8 days. But what was really unique about this year is, I think everyone remembers, we started out with extremely low flows in April. Then we saw a very fast melt of the snow that was in the high country, boosted flows up around 200, 220 KCFS. So we had quite a bookend of flows or environmental characteristics that we're evaluating under the survival study this year, which I think will yield some interesting data points. We had some fish travel from Wells to Rocky Reach as fast as 17.8 hours. We had one fish take 933 hours, which is about 40 days. That fish was released in the second release at below Wells and seemed to just put travel on cruise control and didn't even was oblivious to the fact that flows picked up and the river got, you know, fast and furious, but just took its sweet time. But that fish is a true testament. I mean, it spent 40 days in the reservoir at Rocky Reach, past Rocky Reach, and was actually detected in the forebay of Rock Island, which is our downstream detection gate. So that fish did survive the Rocky Reach project and its journey through that, which is great. I think it's a really good testament to the environment that the Rocky Reach Reservoir provides for fish, no matter how long they reside in it. Flows, as I said, the average flow was about 152 KCFS, but we started the study at a low of 46.3 KCFS. It hit a maximum flow of 227 KCFS. The study was designed to be a no-spill study, but when we see these high, fast runoff periods, there's just only so many tools in the toolbox that the Rocky Reach operators and the system operators can use to maintain those no-spill criteria. Energy Planning and Trading was another group that we worked very closely with and was very supportive of our survival study and actually maintained our 0% spill desires when we got pretty close to having the spill. They got really creative on what they could do for us to maintain those conditions as long as we could, so we greatly appreciate that. But we also did have some spill volumes as high as 82 kcfs. You saw on the previous slide, though, with the gear being deployed, we do have gear on the spillway at Rocky Reach, so we do know those individual fish that passed via the spillway when it was opportunistically available. And so we will be able to provide our stakeholders on the coordinating committee at still an estimate of survival of just powerhouse and juvenile fish bypass passage, because we will remove those fish that went through the spillway from the mathematical calculation of survival. So we will be able to provide that, but at the same time illustrate that there is high survival through the spillway as well. It just won't be factored into the survival estimate for turbid and JFB routes. So next steps, Blue Reef Environmental is currently working on our data set with the 24 deployment locations as well as 1,100 tags. Every time that tag goes off, sometimes it's detected by up to 7 or 8 hydrophones. And Blue Reef Environmental has about a little north of a million detection points to go through and sift through and determine where fish passed and when they passed and things of that nature. So they're working on that data set currently. We're hoping to hand that off to an external stakeholder, Skalski Statistical Service, who will actually start crunching the survival estimates and any appropriate corrections. And then we should receive survival results in August of this year. So
when that fish goes through there, does the data collection system know that it's an individual, you know, it's reaching multiple points and it can track that one number? So it's not, you know, it's not just counting raw data.
Yeah, that's a great question, Commissioner McKenna. It's a little bit of both. So each tag has a unique ping rate that is unique to that fish, and they vary by a fraction of a second. And then at the same time, the deployment in the forebay of Rocky Reach is highly coordinated with one another, and everything is synced on a GPS clock. So essentially, when that tag goes off, it arrives at a millimeter of a second at one site versus other. There's a fraction of a difference there. And based on the location and the time sync of that detection, we can determine where that fish is. Mm-hmm. Based on the very, very slight difference in arrival time of that signal from one receiver to another.
Wow, that's interesting.
So yeah, so it's very important. The small pontoon boats, if commissioners were out during the study, those are actually synced to the GPS clock, and they had cell modems on them as well. So we were getting live data out to ensure that everything was still synced up from a time perspective as well as a position perspective on a fraction of every 2 minutes, I believe.
Wow. I want to thank you for allowing me to be there. It was not only good for me to be able to observe what you do, but then in future events that I've been at, speaking with members of Bonneville and other locations that have dams, it's very empowering to know what we do and how serious you guys take the studies. I mean, your whole team is like a, I know there's a lot of effort that goes behind the scenes, but it seems so seamless on your part. And for you to be able to take me through it, really explain the steps, has been very helpful. Again, and at different presentations where we've been, where we know that our dams are under attack, for us to say, but here in Chelan County, we are taking these studies very seriously, and we are doing what we can for the habitat and the environment, and being able to invite people to come and be present and observe, so that we can hopefully share the story and encourage others to do as well as we have. So, again, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
It's really given me a lot of confidence in what we do.
Yeah, well, thank you, Commissioner Allen, for making time to come out with us. That was a pretty good morning. I think we even got to see some base jumping occur possibly as well, too.
Yes,
so, yeah, we saw a little bit of everything.
Somebody I know from Chelan. Yeah. Let's just
say we saw a little bit of everything. Yeah, but I think, you know, it's you know, the data from these previous studies has yielded so much information, especially with the narrative that's being changed on hydropower with respect to hydropower in the Columbia and the Snake River, as well as, you know, we see the data we're collecting in 2023 being in a verification status to being extremely valuable to show that Rocky Reach is still passing fish in a very safe manner per the HCP.
Much to be learned by others, for sure.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
So did you happen to give Commissioner Allen the opportunity to perform surgery and insert the tag?
We did not. No. So we actually had, we used to have a staff that was pretty trained, internal staff that's pretty trained in surgical procedures. But since we hadn't conducted a study at Rocky Reach since 2011, we brought in some pretty high level surgical taggers two of which from LGL out of Canada, which they've been tagging for over 20 years. And we actually brought an individual from Pacific Northwest National Laboratory who is involved in a lot of actual publications on the proper way to insert and surgically apply sutures and things of that nature to juvenile salmon and steelhead. So we had a pretty good team. I didn't even attempt to tag a fish this year, neither did anyone on our staff. I mean,
it is much more complicated than I anticipated.
It is.
And thank you also for sharing the cost of those tags.
Yes.
You don't think of that always, but I'm sure Kelly does. Yeah. Thank you again.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments, commissioners?
I'd like to just commend our team. It's quite a challenge to have the stewardship value to protect fish and birds and at the same time keep water flowing through turbines and keep the power lines operating and providing reliable service. And you can tell just the ownership that they have and all the logistics and things that they're juggling to try and make both those things happen, and they do a great job at it. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I think I speak for all my fellow commissioners when I say we on a regular basis go back to visit our policymakers in Washington, D.C., and we invariably hear, dams are bad for fish and, what could we do to prevent, mortality? And we are really proud to be able to say, come visit our dams, because we're doing what it takes to have fish come through our dams. And we are really proud of what you guys do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Yeah. So should I just continue?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, in the past, we've taken a pause here. So, commissioners, we're up to the consent agenda. The consent agenda has been modified to include. But I figured at the end of the regular session.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I think we're going to finish by noon. Yeah. So the consent agenda has been modified to include resolutions 8, 9, and 10. Is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Okay, we're down to resolution 11.
Okay, I'd like to invite George Velasquez up. And speaking of fish, George is here for a resolution that has to do with our fish bypass system. It's declaring Whitney Equipment Company Incorporated of Bothell, Washington as the sole source supplier of flight pumps for Rocky Reach Dam, contract number 23-13061. Welcome, George.
Thank you. Good morning. George Velasquez, manager for Engineering Project Management Department. So as Kirk mentioned, a sole source resolution for flight, also manufactured or distributed by Whitney Equipment. So a little bit on the request. Due to the juvenile fish bypass system and the 22 odd years that it's been in service, some of these pumps are starting to fail. And in order for us to maintain good, reliable operation, we've developed a business case in 2020-2021 that identified pumps needed repair or replacement. So a little bit of background on this one. Currently at Rocky Reach, we have 29 flight pumps that service and develop a certain attraction flow for this juvenile fish bypass system that helps us pass fish through our juvenile fish bypass system. The existing flight pumps have been in service roughly 22 years, like I mentioned. And we're starting to see some of the components, particularly gearboxes and other components that cannot be repaired or replaced because they no longer make them. So these pumps had a service life of roughly 15 years, was their original OEM service life. We've kept them with central maintenance inspection and operation maintenance programs. We've kept them running for, like I mentioned, roughly 22 years. A lot of these pumps still have some good life left in them, but we want to have the opportunity to procure the remainder that we need replacement as we need them. So a little bit of more justification on this one. Inspections have been completed by central maintenance annually. So we've got good log records on how they're operating and how they're functioning and what components we need replacement on. We want to proceed with a sole source resolution for purchasing spare pumps as planned, budgeted in 2023, and possibly more in the future as we see those failing and we can't repair them. Continue with inspections of the pumps that are out of service, investigate repair options and costs. We also want to continue to inspect all other operating pumps, maintain that operation maintenance inspection system. We also want to install the spare pumps as needed and replace those. We also want to purchase additional pumps as the spare pumps used at a cost of not to exceed $12,017,896. That does not include shipping or Washington State sales tax. If equipment escalation exceeds that estimate, we will come back to the commission and ask for additional funds because this is a projected view through 2028, 2029, if those pumps continue to fail. The pumps will be, these pumps that are designed by Flight and distributed by Whitney Equipment fit our existing system. So there's 10 stacks of three pumps. And these pumps fit precisely in these frames. And they also, they're designed for, like I mentioned, a specific flow. So that's why we're asking for the sole source request for these pumps. To maintain the district's culture of operational excellence, comply with the HCP obligations that that we're just talked to, the procurement of the proposed pumps should be considered. This action will help ensure that the required pumps are operational throughout the life of the JFB system. Any questions?
Commissioners. So when I was out there the other day going through and looking at the racks down in central maintenance and the work that was being done on it, it appears to me that those, the longer that we're using those pumps, there are things that we're learning about them, and that the learning is now generating differences and improvements that with the new pumps that are we're replacing them with. Is the company works closely with us? So that's a question. Is my observation correct that those pumps, even though they fit in the exact rack at the size, etc., they're improving and getting better, even though they've had a great run? There's just this continual learning and improvement or communication between the ourselves and the company that's producing them. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Commissioner. So Flight, also known as Xylem, they manufacture these plants, these pumps. One of our pumps failed about a year and a half ago, and they actually shipped it to Sweden, and they did a side-by-side test on our old existing pump. They repaired it versus a new, slightly new design, slightly different gearbox system, and they tested it side-by-side. Now, granted, it was a bench test, right? It was in monitored conditions. But some of the things they saw was improved efficiency, so less power draw was one of the things that they claimed. They also improved the impeller. So, yes, they're working with us. They also gave us additional options that we're not currently ready to purchase, but additional sensing equipment inside the pump for whining temperatures, leakage sensors inside the pumps. So, those are some options we can explore in the future. Right now, we don't have the juvenile fish bypass control system to even get that information out of those pumps. But these pumps will be in the future if we install certain control systems. We would be able to extract that information.
Well, as Kelly was saying, as we deal with other utilities and share from a layman's perspective, how cool that system is. I I mean, it is truly amazing. Yeah. And it was quite a learning opportunity for me to really understand how unique those that system is. And it makes it, I needed to understand soul source and how incredibly specific that piece of machinery, that process is. So yeah, it blew me away.
Yeah, it's definitely a one-of-a-kind system. Yeah.
Any other questions? Now, if I understood you correctly, the system has 30 pumps?
It has slots for 30. We only have 29 installed. So any given time, we need 19 to 21 pumps operating, and they need to be ready to go. So the 21 through 29, so that's 8 pumps, right? Those are backups, but any given time, we have 5 to 6 that are not operational. So we need to have some in stock and in spares ready to go. And again, our central maintenance crews do the maintenance and the installation.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioners, Resolution 11 has been presented. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 11. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Manager items.
Okay. I'd like to invite Ron Slabaugh up when he's able to. Ron's going to give a regional water system update. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you, Kurt. Morning, commissioners. I can provide an update this morning on so specific to the regional water second source project. I think folks here are aware that regional for close to 10 years now has been contemplating a second source to the existing East Bank source. The last regional comprehensive planning that was completed in 2018 identified that we could reach capacity, both our physical capacity and water rights capacity at East Bank in the 2035 to 2036. That's only about a dozen years away. We started by actively pursuing a source, hopeful to find something similar at East Bank on the Chelan County side, drilled a series of wells and just were unable to find anything. Now, in order to meet redundancy and capacity and water quality needs, one of the only other alternatives that we came up with was surface water out of the Columbia River. It's interesting to note City of Wenatchee actually had a surface water plant back prior to, in the 70s, back prior to East Bank being constructed. Over the last couple of years, the port also has been looking to develop water supply in Malaga for what we know now as Microsoft, and the port had some dollars available and offered to fund a study for developing a surface water source on the Chelan County side. And the port did indeed fund that. The regional members got together. We solicited proposals from engineering firms, selected Stantec Consulting, and over last year they prepared this study and evaluation and ultimately a cost estimate for a surface water plant on the Columbia River. For the purposes of the study only, we selected the district's Holly Street site. They really wanted to nail us down on a specific site that for the example purposes, they could identify all the issues like intake off of the Columbia River, what we do with residuals that are removed from the water, pumping, I mean, just all in full on analysis. And since the district owns the site, and also it happens to be in close proximity to the regional transmission main, so we didn't have a long transmission main to pump into. It's also close to city sewer. As I mentioned, the water treatment does create residuals that it's easy, if it's available, just to send it to the local treatment plant for disposal. So after several month effort, the results of that study were that the initial or projected cost is in the range of $85 to $100 million. $1 million for a facility that would treat 15 million gallons per day. Now, we chose 15 million gallons per day because that happens to be the average day demand out 20 years for all three of the regional members, but also the maximum day demand for both the city and Chelan PUD. You know, thinking that our single largest failure that we could experience now would be on one of the pipeline crossings over the Otobashan Bridge or under the Wenatchee River. So if we lost East Bank supply to Chelan County, we'd want to have adequate capacity to meet the max day demand for the city and Chelan PUD. We did, Commissioner Bergen and I attended a meeting here back in May with the Port District to share the results of that study with them and also just inquire, you know, their level of interest also. And we got an update from the Port. They have been developing water supply with the Malaga Water District, have quite a large expenditure investment in that system. And at that time, they had drilled a well that they thought would be very productive. And it's up in the air right now whether they will need additional source capacity from regional. There's still some interest in a redundant supply from regional, but that's yet to be determined. And I haven't heard yet from the Port how that well tested out and whether they could need additional capacity. One other thing that the regional members identified at that meeting, of course, is that some things have changed with demand forecasting since that 2018 comp plan. Of course, East Wenatchee Water District is completing improvements to their system for some Microsoft data centers. We, of course, have connected the Diamond Foundry, which is a fairly large water user. So the city committed to go back and look at the water use records for themselves in East Wenatchee Water District and us and just validate that demand forecasting that was done in 2018 to see if that 2035 to 2036 estimate of when we exceed capacity has moved any sooner, any closer to us or not. So that's underway. And one other thing that we discussed at that meeting, not necessarily second source related, but worthy to mention, with the Confluence Parkway project, the alignment of Confluence Parkway over the Wenatchee River happens to be atop the regional transmission main. So it's something that the regional members are aware of. We're going to have to work with the city and its designer through the process of designing Confluence Parkway to ensure that that line is protected, moved, so that we retain that reliable source of water to the city and the PUD. That's just something that's on our radar that we'll be working with the city on over the years.
Yeah, can you explain why the Malaga water isn't compatible with the regional as far as blending and that sort of thing?
Malaga has, so they have their groundwater source. It's a fairly hard water. And we haven't specifically looked at the compatibility of, you know, regional with Malaga, but with the regional second source study, we did look at blending. That's a very important consideration. And because you can run into mostly aesthetic issues of two different water chemistries being mixed together. Now, we feel that since East Bank pulls out, it's in hydraulic connection with the Columbia River, and that a Columbia River surface water, their water source, that there's technologies available or we can match those chemistries where we won't have issues. But Malaga's water is pretty hard compared to what we get out of East Bank.
And so if high magnesium or something like that?
Well, hardness is magnesium and calcium ions primarily. So there can be some aesthetic issues with blending those waters. We would run into the same thing potentially with the regional backup emergency backup wells that are over in East Wenatchee. Those have hard water as well. Any questions?
Commissioners, any questions? You actually raised 1,000 questions.
I'll be following up. Okay. I've jotted some down.
Yeah. Okay. One question, you know, maybe you can answer right here, I don't know. When we talk about looking out to 2035 and the need for water rights and the increase in demand from entities like the Diamond Foundry and Microsoft, is that considered, quote, consumptive use, or is there a difference because they're using it for cooling and returning it somewhere, I'm assuming? Maybe they evaporate it all. I don't know.
Well, I believe a lot of it's evaporated. And let me just clarify with respect to water rights. We'll reach our water rights capacity at East Bank in that 2035, 2036 timeframe. Okay. But those water rights that Regional acquired from the Pioneer Water Users Association are in addition to that. In that comp plan update, we estimated we had adequate water rights for 50 years or more.
Okay.
It's just source capacity.
Source capacity. And expense.
And expense. Correct. So, you know, Regional has been increasing its wholesale costs that we all pay, us, City, and East Wenatchee Water District, for 5 or 6 years in a row now, 10% per year, just in anticipation. We know we're going to have to do something. So we're making those small incremental changes. It's all easy for us to adjust to in order to begin saving some money. And that's how, with all the engineering expenses that Regional has incurred thus far, and even some upgrades that Regional has done, has been able to pay cash for, hasn't had to go out and borrow any money.
Ron, the planned treatment facility also has expandability. I mean, that's it.
That's correct.
And how much can that expand?
We had asked to be able to expand from 15 MGD, million gallons per day, up to 30 million gallons per day. And the technology that was selected after a pretty thorough review process is membranes, which have become increasingly popular with drinking water. You know, long ago, we used mostly sand filtration, and it's very effective as well, but there's been a number of studies done, in addition to this one that we just completed, that have shown that membranes and sand filtration, cost-wise, are pretty similar on a project of this size. But membranes offer other advantages, like ease of expandability, for example, or the capability to ramp capacity up and down over a short period of time. That's second. The third is they handle changes in intake water quality quite a bit better than what sand filtration historically does. So when you see the Columbia River running just a little bit muddier than normal, the membranes tend to be able to handle that more effectively than what sand filtration can.
And there is a waste associated.
With water treatment or wastewater treatment, what we're essentially doing is converting the contaminants into a form that can be effectively removed. And the membranes, think of it as a pipe or a straw. There's just tens of thousands or millions of them with tiny, tiny holes. So the contaminants are held on the outside of that straw and just the clean water gets through. But those contaminants turn in what I refer to as residuals. Just think of it as solids that have to be removed. And the easiest thing when it's available is just to pump that down or flow by gravity to a treatment plant where it can be removed. If the treatment plant isn't available, then additional treatment is constructed at the water treatment site in order to deal with those residuals.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ron?
So that's a back flush through the membrane to remove that?
And yeah, the automated control system from the manufacturers includes that back pulse, back flush. So it runs, pulls water through the membranes outside in for a period of time until there's either time or there's too much pressure loss across the membrane, and then it'll back flush. And then in a lesser frequency, could be weeks or months, there's a chemical cleaning. Those different racks of membranes can be taken out of service and cleaned with chemicals and put back into service. And some of the facilities that were referenced by Stantec, in fact, one of them I think we even visited, the life of those membranes can be upwards of 15 to 20 years.
Okay. Thank you so much for that update.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for the questions.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Ron.
I'd like to invite another Ron up.
Ron Gibbs.
Give us an update on the insurance renewal.
Thank you, Kirk.
Welcome.
Yeah, so in the June 26th presentation, we mentioned we'd come back and share the final results, reporting on the negotiations that we completed this year for the program renewal. And you can see that we have, with all of the negotiations completed, an increase of 17.7%, which is higher than we prefer, but an improvement over last year's 23.4%. And we expect, based on current trends, that the insurance markets will help us achieve better results next year. And we can also report that we are under the 2023 budget by 2.4% now that we have all the calculations for taxes and fees and everything included. And then I would add one highlight for the year that happened since our presentation. We were able to negotiate an increase in our earthquake coverage. We had about 42% of our program that provided a $10 million deductible cap. And we've expanded that up to 60% of the program. And the way this deductible cap works is traditionally insurance deductibles for earthquake are comprised of 2% of your property value. So at Rocky Reach, the valuation is over $3 billion. So we would have had about a $64 million deductible. And now 60% of our program is capping that deductible at $10 million. And we're trying to continue to expand that. And it's actually a credit to our London brokers. It's very, very unusual to have a cap like this in the insurance program market. So I'm pretty happy with the result they've been able to achieve. So that's one good highlight for the year. But really, that's the result of negotiations. Are there any follow-up questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
Yep. Ron, I just want to say I am continually amazed that you can even find insurance. not working, obviously, with a utility district, but with a lot of businesses in our area and the high risks due to fire, you know, non-renewal is a real issue. Rate increases are through the roof and insurance companies are struggling. So I can only imagine. I'm surprised you have as much as hair as you do, actually, too. And it's not gray yet. So thank you.
I wore my toupee.
Yeah, it's not easy.
No, I appreciate that. And we've got a good team of brokers, both in the U.S. and in London, that are helping find coverage when many are struggling. And we've had our own struggles. But the good work that's been going on for wildfire mitigation at the district has really impacted our ability to keep insurance and keep the rates down as much as possible. So that'll be important going forward.
Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. Okay, I'd like to invite Sean Smith and Janet Jaspers up for some of our contract awards.
Good morning, Commissioners. Sean Smith, Managing Director of Energy Resources. I'm here to introduce the topic. I'll let Janet take over for the slides, but just a little summary. As the board knows, you've agreed to the long-term marketing strategy. So among that is 20 to 30% load, 40 to 50% cost of production, and then this category is 20 to 30% market-based slices. So that's where this contract falls into, and I will pass it off to Janet to go into detail.
Yes, thanks, Sean. Janet Jaspers, Director of Energy Planning and Trading. So just kind of before I get really dive into this, just wanted to thank the whole team. And so besides just our group, there's a lot of people across the district who really help us. So Dan Garrison from Generation, they do a kind of update a slice disclosure, really give us kind of a look at the condition of any operating equipment or deficiencies. Like if we think we might have a crack, we disclose that before anyone would bid on our output. Charles Von Rees does legal, helps us with our contracting. Jamie Mitchell from middle office, she just really helps with the contract. Sue Wiersma does a lot of the credit stuff, and she's from middle office. Chad Bowman and Steve Wickle take a look at our slice disclosure from kind of that transmission point of view. Then in energy planning and trading, Mike Bradshaw helps out. This year we had Henry Kern and Brandon Carnahan really put together a lot of the information that we put out there on our Slice website. So Anyway, thanks to that whole team. Really, it takes a large team to get one of these auctions pulled off. So just what we have for this product, it's a slice of both Rocky Reach and Hawk Island, and we had auctioned off 5%. It's a 5-year term. The environmental attributes are carbon-free value of it goes with it. So, in the past, we had kind of unbundled it and kept some of those for ourselves, but in this contract, it was conveyed with the contract. And then in this product, it's not like a set amount, like, oh, you get 55 megawatt hours flat. It's as produced from the plant. So if you have a couple unit outages, you would get less. Or if you have high water, you would get more. Low water, you would get less. And so we really kind of do that risk mitigation with this contract.
Janet, I have a question on the carbon. On the carbon attributes, like you said, we normally kept those, a portion of them, I guess. Is that a way of enhancing the product? Is letting that go? Is that
correct?
So you get, did we get more value because of that, or does
right?
Okay.
Yeah, kind of in the past, that carbon-free value, there wasn't hardly any premium, if any, probably like 20 years ago. It was just kind of generic power. We sold generic megawatt hours. And so the price of a gas generation, what you could get at the market versus ours, was exactly the same. And so now there's going to be a premium for that carbon-free attribute. And so we will actually create renewable energy credits in a system and then transfer those like once a quarter to the slice window.
And then the third value that's brought in is capacity. So part of the Western Resource Adequacy Program, with capacity being value, that also adds to it. So those three are major components now, where it used to be energy only. Well, suddenly now those other two is really propping up the value.
Is there a way of measuring the value of those in the, against what we have been doing? I mean, can we separate that and say, well this is worth so much? I don't know. Maybe I'm asking something.
They bid as a whole.
There's no way of really separating and measuring what those are actually worth. Because it seems like carbon, you know, these carbon allowances are, you know, it's a sought-after product now, just about as much as the power.
That's right. So. Yeah, so kind of a 5-year term would kind of have a different value. So sometimes we sell just carbon-free on day ahead. And get kind of a premium for that then. But kind of, if you can count on it for 5 years and put it in an integrated resource plan and count it towards meeting that Clean Energy Transformation Act, sometimes everyone wants to be more compliant and would pay up. So I think, depending on the use, it definitely a premium, but the bids that we get are just kind of one bid. So you could have just the energy price, the carbon-free adder. They might deduct because we had disclosed the condition of Rocky Reach units or Rock Island units. They might add on just because of the resource adequacy. There's dispatchable capacity. And so we just say, we just want one price so we can kind of compare that to other bidders.
Yeah, I'm just kind of trying to understand how all that comes together. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And can I ask a question on the capacity? When you speak about the RAP and the capacity that involves, is it that it's increased our capacity because we're a part of that?
Increase the value of our product because other utilities require to be part of that. They've got to procure so much capacity if their capacity is short. And so right now what we've seen in the market is there's limited supply, and we are one of the people that provide that, and so the price has increased. And you'll see in places like California, there's an extreme shortage of capacity where prices have gone up multiple times.
auction results. So several bidders actually responded in this competitive bid process. We all kind of wait, watch the inbox, and all of these people send in their bids so we can evaluate. Puget Sound Energy was awarded this license contract with the highest bid, and we're currently working with Puget on implementing. And so the first flow date is January 1st, 2024. And with that, they're going to have the current long-term slice, which is 25%, slice number 35, which is 5%, and then this slice 38, another 5%. So they are currently at 30% of our system, Rocky Beach, Rock Island system, and they will be 35% come January 1st. So how does this agreement meet the best for the most for the longest? And so we talked about Charles and Leal and everyone else. So we look at our slice template and we updated it before we even start the process. So we can have this updated best modern contract for us. The contract really provides revenue to support stable and predictable retail rates. Supports that wholesale surplus hedging strategy for customer owners too, and really kind of balances that with risk reduction for both the stream flow and outage risks. The contract captures, it's a fixed price contract, so it captures a market-based value in addition to reducing risk. And it's a collaborative partnership with another Washington State electric utility, so which is also good because we're both serving customers inside the state. There's just a bunch of benefits for both the district and the purchaser with this contract. I probably want to highlight number three, locking in that carbon-free hydro. So this will really help Puget with their Clean Energy Transformation Act and that Climate Commitment Act. And then also number five, we're starting that resource adequacy program. It's non-binding currently, but will be binding in a couple of years. And Puget is capacity short, so they're trying to get resources that have that firm capacity with them. And that's all we had. Any other questions?
Questions, commissioners?
I would just like to add that there is an awful lot of work that goes into these, and I appreciate the team and appreciate you, Janet, mentioning everybody involved. And you know, Puget Sound Energy is a longstanding, we have a longstanding relationship with them, and so this was great from the standpoint of working with them, continuing to work with them, and also just keeping that carbon-free energy and state load-serving entity is a great outcome here. So,
sort of like second what you said on keeping that in the state. We've heard when we're back in Washington D.C. from our congressional delegation that I don't think they've known in the past where our electricity goes, and it's really good to be able to share with them that a whole lot of it is residing in Western Washington at this moment in time. That's a really big issue with them. There's a lot of our Congress people that,
yeah, then
plus that's their constituents.
And then you have a Vista too. So, yeah. You know. Yeah.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'd like to invite Tracy Yunt up and Libby Stevens up. Libby is here on her first day as the new communications manager. I'll let Tracy do the introduction.
Good morning, everybody. Tracy Yunt, Director of External Affairs, and very happy that July 11th has shown up because this is the day Libby shows up. 10. Living in the future. Thank you. I probably got something else wrong on the little release I sent out today. Anyway, so I just wanted to highlight four things that I first noted in Libby's application. And then I'll turn it over for her to describe herself a little better than I will. So first was a degree in agricultural communications. I thought how great for our community, in addition to the energy sector, all the ag we have in the area. Great WSU degree there. Extensive emergency management and training certifications. We go through training every year, and Libby has a great deal of background and training in that area. A great deal of engagement in the community. You'll note in the email I sent out today, a lot of participation in groups outside of work. And then just the role she played at Wenatchee Valley College, leading the strategic communication. So we're very lucky to have Libby, and this is our commission.
Great. Thank you. Hi. I'm excited to be here, and I loved hearing what you saw. That was great. I do have a degree that combines communications and the technical, which has always been fun because I love sharing the technical information about whatever that is for the job that I'm doing, and now it will be the PUD, with the public. So really distilling that down into something that's so cool and interesting. And, oh, I totally get that when you read the newsletter and you see the basic understanding. It feels really good to be able to share that with the public. As far as emergency management, unfortunately, in K-12 and higher education, emergencies, and you can just fill in those blanks, happen a lot more often, and we're doing a lot of training in that respect. And so it's unfortunate that I had to do that for many years, but it's great to be able to bring that experience to the PUD. And I did enjoy my time at the college, but I'm so excited to be here and be involved in the community in a new way at the PUD. So thank you again for this wonderful welcome.
Welcome, and could you share a little bit more about who you are?
Sure. Again, my name is Libby Stevens. I've lived in Wenatchee here for 15 years. I actually, after college, moved to Montana, so came from Helena back to Washington State, and I do have family in the area, but not here in Wenatchee in the state. And I worked at the college in a number of capacities, but almost all of those were in communications and marketing. So it has been wonderful to be able to share the stories of the college, to promote WVC, and to gain a lot of experience in the local community. And then I am active in different clubs and entities around the community as well.
This is totally personal on my part, but what took you to Helena, Montana?
Got married and first jobs.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. My wife is from Montana. So, I mean, anytime you're from Montana, you have to have that conversation.
I think the only time a female goes to Helena is because they got married.
I did love it. We did love it. So. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Welcome.
Glad you're here.
Okay. I'd like to invite Sarah DeLozier and Lyle Moore up. They're going to circle back from our discussion at the last meeting on the latecomers policy proposed changes, and just wanting to summarize and then see if there are any more comments before they plan to come back with a resolution with a changed policy. So welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners, and the extra two we missed last time, Commissioner Allen and Berggren. My name is Sarah DeLozier. I am the customer service and dispatch supervisor here at Chelan PUD for almost 25 years.
I'm Lyle Moore, supervisor for customer service engineering.
Today, as Kirk shared, we did want to circle back with the latecomers policy. Hope everyone had a chance to review additional information about it. What we did share last time was the policy itself, some challenges and opportunities, and we wanted to follow back up on that today. Again, our intent is to better the customer's experience while aligning with industry standards. Good.
So as we reviewed the policy, and as Sarah said there, we looked real hard at industry standards. We looked at what's important to the PUD, best for the most, for the longest, and operational excellence. And this slide here shows that we looked at three options. We developed three options, and that's what we presented last month there. A status quo is option one, a staff preferred option of eliminating the policy, and a staff supported option three there as a phased in approach of making some changes that gets us some efficiency and manages some risk, saves us some cost, and still provides a good quality customer service experience.
Fair question on these latecomer fees and tracking these line extensions. Couple questions. How many man hours or people hours is required in the PUD in tracking this? And the second question that is that when these lines are put in, they're put in privately with private funds. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. So policy has that the customer pays for labor and material and excavation, and then our crews come back and install the electrical facilities, the cables, the transformers, and the connections on that. And then as far as the tracking component of that is, anytime we do some type of connection, we have to review if there's a line extension out there or not. You know, are we connecting to something that someone paid some sort of money to build those original facilities?
Okay, so the customer's paying for the line extension, and then we're using that extension, I guess. We can upgrade it and do all those things within that. With the conduit or the water, whatever we're talking about, correct?
Yep, current policy has that the customer pays for that infrastructure to be built.
And then we maintain it if anything goes wrong.
Right, and then we take over ownership of it.
Ownership.
Okay. And then the PUD owns and operates that indefinitely, as long as that asset's out there. We pay for any upgrades. We pay for repairs on it. We do use it. We connect to it. At times we go in and modify existing line extensions to increase capacity by rebuilding it. Everything has a life, so transformers have a life.
So the reimbursement then, let's say we track that over a 10-year period, then that reimbursement, if somebody connects, has to pay a certain percentage of the original cost of the line.
Yep, there's a cost methodology that the second connector to that, if the original meets certain criteria, there's a cost methodology that determines a portion of money that we request from the second connector that we reimburse back to the first contributor that actually built the line, that paid for that line there. Criteria, the policy dictates who's qualified and who's not. There's some exceptions to that.
And then there's a sunset on that.
There's a sunset on that.
Okay.
Yep.
Typically, I've heard 20 years.
It's 10 years by policy.
Okay.
So some of the recommendations, we want to change that sunset to make it better, easy to manage by staff. We want to change some of the criteria, what's eligible and not eligible in there. So we're trying to set staff up to be successful. We at times can spend a tremendous amount of time talking to a customer about, hey, you're not eligible anymore because of something.
What's the difficulty in just to the utility extending the line and not go through this process at all of, you know, the customer paying a fee and then the utility taking it over? And it seems to be really convoluted, a lot of man hours involved in tracking these kinds of things. It seems to me it'd be much simpler just to say there's going to be a line extension, and if someone needs to pay a certain percentage of that, you know, like a private public partnership, you do it once, one and done, and it's over with, and then we take possession of that. I have experience in that a little bit, and with the Shasta Water District, where we had line extensions as well, and we just take it over, and it'd be done, and we have ownership of those lines, although there might be some private, monies going into it, but it seems to me it's simpler, it's less man hours for the district. Yeah, it's upfront cost, but I think you recoup those costs over time as development occurs to help pay for those kinds of infrastructure payments.
So if I hear you correctly, are you saying that the PUD should pay an initial portion of that construction?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, if you're looking at a place, I mean, we know if a place is going to grow or not. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket science to say, well, yeah, this is a four-home development, but it's going to end up being 20.
Right.
You know, I think we need to look at those things moving forward. Instead of having this small line extension, and then we track it for right. for latecomers, three for 20 years, and we're doing all of this stuff. To me, it's simpler that we would put it in, you get it done, and then you look at the future growth as paying for all of this cost just right. through, you know, growth.
Right.
We'll pay for it. That is growth, paying for, you know, growth. And but somebody needs to facilitate this thing and help. So, I mean, I'm glad you brought this up. I mean, I guess if it's my opinion, I'd take option two and just be done with it. But I understand there's some people out there that have, you know, were promised certain things, and I think right. we have to kind of follow through with that if that's what we promised. But a new policy moving forward where we actually get rid of these kinds of things, I think it's a positive thing for growth and a positive thing for helping facilitate some of this housing shortages and stuff that we're yeah. having. And why do we want to be in the way? That's how I see it. So.
Right. So to answer a couple of those questions, Commissioner, if we do look at option two there and eliminate the policy, it doesn't eliminate the customers that are within the 10-year component right now. We would not do that. That's a bait and switch. So we have an obligation, and our recommendation does not change that obligation. So we would manage those for the remainder of the 10 years. Some of those have a year left. Some of those have 10 years left. So that's a commitment that we made, and we're ready to do that. What we would do is draw a line in the sand and say, as of this day forward, any new connections would not be eligible for any kind of latecomers component. We would change that and basically eliminate the policy and have a sunset date on it. So that's just to be clear on that.
Would some of those line extensions be public-private partnerships in that? Or would it be just total? Well, you know, a lot of times there's an extension that needs to go out to a certain area, and, right. and the landowner or the developer will say, well, I'll pay for that, or mm-hmm. portion of it. Mm-hmm. And then the PUD can come in and say, well, we know there's going to be more growth than what you're doing. We want to upgrade it. Okay, so we're going to upgrade this thing, and that's on the PUD in order to, you know, establish, you know, future capacity. Oops. Understanding that capacity will grow, and yep. so that's what I'm talking about with public-private partnership. They're going to pay for the line extension, right. but the PUD pays for any upgrade that
right.
we need to.
So we have exercised that already okay. to some respects. So when we have customers that want to build into an area, and their load is, I only need single phase load. Or they give us a load amount that maybe number two primary cable can satisfy. We have used the opportunity where the district's gone in and said, we want to use the opportunity. You're digging the ditch. We're going to increase the size of the facilities. And the PUD through a capital project will pay that difference. So we have that relationship now mm-hmm. and those options. And any latecomer component is based on what the customer contributed, not what the PUD contributed. So we do have that flexibility today. To talk a little bit about how we got here, latecomers has been around for a long time in some form. It's migrated and changed over time to where we've taken the mindset of growth pays for growth, let some of the customers share those burdens for that individual project to help manage rates, to keep our overall rates down. So we've looked at a lot of scenarios like that. So where we think we're going forward is, if we look at the industry trend, the trend is going to where latecomers is starting to go away from customers paying it all. The PUD paying a portion of this. Let the customer pay for more of this. Growth pays for growth.
Well, you bring up the policy, growth pays for growth, and this is where I guess I have some interest in all this. It's how you define growth, paying
exactly.
for growth. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it up front, or is it through the development of the area? Because that's considered growth.
Yes.
And as you grow organically within an area, that growth is going to pay more and more of the services and the infrastructure mm-hmm. that's being provided.
Right.
Correct?
Yes.
That's kind of how I see it, and I see growth paying for growth.
And that's a way of recouping some of those costs through rates. Yes, there is a way
that's how we define that.
You're right. And it comes down to when you spend the money.
Yeah.
We're spending the money now in anticipation that we'll recoup our costs with rates. Or are we asking for a customer to spend it now and not use not using the rate component to recoup all of our costs?
Do we make that analysis right now when a line extension is pushed out? Do we look at it that way?
No. No, we look more, we look at it more in the system capacity component of it. You know, what do we need operationally today? What do we think we need operationally in 5 years or 10 years? Okay. We look at it like that. But we don't go in and define it looking at a cost recovery component. Historically, we did.
We used to do that a long time ago.
We used to do that.
You know, as we move forward and we have to change our policy, mm-hmm. I would certainly entertain that mm-hmm. as a component of the new policy as we move forward, that we start maybe relook at this stuff a little bit and just, you know, think about this a little more. We had policies put in place years ago for certain reasons, mm-hmm. and those reasons now have matured, mm-hmm. and we've grown, and we're in a completely different financial place than we were 20 years ago. Completely different. I would say night and day. And as we move forward, I think, you know, we need to look at a lot of things. We need to look at, you know, how we look at moving forward and what our mission and vision is. And this is a great way to start that conversation. I think we need to talk about it. We have evolved to a utility, a public utility that needs to serve. That should be our moral obligation. And how do we best do that and serve the population? Because I seriously believe that our policies today, although it's been very, very good for the PUD and getting our financial in order, thank you, mm-hmm. Kelly, when we look at the policy today and how our growth in this community is, and all of our communities are growing, and how it's really kind of restrictive in allowing people to, you know, to develop, I guess. And I think it's very important that we are we hurting the people that we're actually trying to serve? I guess that's where I'm coming at. Because of our policy, because costs are going up, mm-hmm. the lower income folks are getting priced out.
Right.
And so one of the things I think is really important for us to say is are we actually retarding this and being a block of some kind in our policy? So let's relook at that. I seriously think that's an important thing for this commission to do, is look at our policy, talk about it, and see if we can improve it and help facilitate some of the problems that we're having out there right now. And we are having problems. All you have to do is drive down the avenue. I mean, there's some problems in the infrastructure. And so we have a role to play. And thank you for bringing this to our attention. Seriously, I think that's a very, very good of you to do that. So thank you. Okay. I'm done. I'm off the soapbox.
Right.
That's it.
Any other commissioner comments?
Where are we still in the middle of a presentation? Where are you going?
They do have one more slide.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to share with you again what we had presented as options. One was to stay and continue doing what we've been doing. Two would be to eliminate the current policy for any new line extensions beginning ideally the first of the year. And then third would be to adjust the policy as is for new line extensions come the first of the year ideally as well. So as Lyle mentioned, while option two is the staff's preferred approach, we really feel that, you know, the customer experience means a lot to our utility, and considering that in this as well and finding ways to lessen risk was important too. So if we were to look at option three, we just want to highlight a few things that came from our study over the last couple of years, really pulling back into what the industry standards were as well, doing the Waputa survey earlier. We found several things that we don't necessarily align with today. So finding that there were minimum project costs included or not included, we didn't include them through industry standards. Those primarily are included. Often, utility is limiting a number of payouts. We are indefinite number of payouts. Often we see less than 10, but occasionally much more than that. As Lyle mentioned earlier, too, lessening the reimbursement term. So going from what we have to today is 10, going down to 4, changing the eligibility, really focusing on those single lot development or customers themselves, We also have the challenge where our utility occasionally, the person who's receiving some money back today may owe our utility money. They have significant late balances that are on their way to collection, trying to keep our utility whole with those. We've also allowed customer receipts. So we've definitely seen opportunities for some challenges with that. It's hard for our staff to validate those receipts, contractor, labor, material, and such, trying to make sure we're doing the best for those subsequent connectors. Just we're certainly trying to validate, but in a trust scenario for sure. Not shown on here, too, is just the reminder that we do want to take away the property sale component. As we mentioned in a previous board session, we have seen several challenges with the property sale component. Customers are very creative, often trying to help their taxes. Maybe they got married and changed their name. Maybe they changed the way they deal with their property themselves. And from a perspective, it can look like a transfer or sale, which does put us in a situation where we may make a decision that may not align with what the customer had done, and just really trying to kind of stay away from their personal decisions and really factor in on things that the utility should be focused on. So we wanted to come back today and just seek any additional feedback and guidance. Thank you, Commissioner Brooker, for your thoughts.
By the way,
no, that's great. No, we appreciate any feedback and thoughts. It's how we become a better utility, so it's important to share those.
Sarah, I have a question.
Yes.
Under eligibility, currently it's residential and commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Under the new policy, it would be just residential. How do we treat commercial in this instance?
Today?
Right.
If a commercial customer were to pay for a line extension, they would be eligible for latecomer reimbursements if a subsequent were to connect.
And so in the future, they would not be eligible for latecomer?
No. Correct. That's our thought. Okay. Also with like industrial customers, they're not eligible. They're not commercial.
Right.
So really thinking of their business model and how they can recoup costs through their business model was the perspective around that.
Thank you. And I live in Squalchuk, and so I know at some point in the future, Mission Ridge is going to do an extension, and it will require a great deal of money to get the kind of capacity they need up on the mountain. And so that's why I was asking that question.
Sure.
So I'm sort of thinking of that in the future as future development.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I wanted to thank you, Carnan, for bringing up some of the points you did. You know, it makes me think about the comprehensive planning that is taking place and throughout different communities. And I do think it's important for us to be participants and be aware of where that future growth is. And you raised some great points when our communities are being forced to grow at certain capacities to meet the comprehensive planning needs, then what is our relationship as a partner in anticipating that growth and providing the infrastructure, because they have mandates upon them? And are we inhibiting some of that growth? And I don't anticipate the answers here today. I just think that those are questions for us to think about. Maybe it's a roundtable down the road. But I appreciate everything that you brought to the table. And certainly I feel as a commissioner that you are the ones doing what you do every single day. And I don't want to be, as much as I don't want to be in the way of growth, I don't want to be in the way of having your team be successful either. So I do appreciate the recommendations that you bring forward. Thank you.
Other commissioner comments? Okay.
I would just add that their plan would be to bring back a resolution with the new policy at the next board meeting for consideration. But also add that I think it'd be a good discussion for us to have, the one that you teed up, Commissioner Bergeron. I would just say we need to make sure we understand all the implications of changing that philosophy, because there's a lot of them. There's all of our processes, all of our staffing levels, financial implications. It would just be real. I think it'd be good discussion to have, and really understand all the implications of, because there would be a lot of implications, and be good education for all.
And that's what we're here for.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We're here to have that discussion.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both. That is all of the manager items I had.
All right. I see Lisa in the back of the room for commissioner travel.
When will they be bringing back their recommendation?
Next meeting.
Next meeting.
Yep. And just a reminder that this can be an incremental step too. The change in policy can be an incremental step towards something else. It's certainly a desire to provide better customer service over what we're able to provide now. And so it can be a, you know, part way there if we want to change it again. We can do that at some point, and it won't be that far down the road. We could, you know, the 4 years is a pretty easy sunset if we needed to. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. So we have some travel in July, no travel in August, so that would be nice. July Waputa meetings are 12 to 14 at the Suquamish Casino and Resort. We have Commissioners Arsenault, McKenna, and Smith attending. We have Commissioner Allen attending PNWER Annual Summit in Boise, 16th through the 21st, and Commissioner Arsenault traveling to Virginia, Arlington, for APPA policymakers, 17 through 21. Then we have Commissioner Arsenault again traveling to Pasco for Energy Northwest, the 25th through the 27th, and from there, we go into September, Waputa meetings in Richland. And I am just asking who would like to be registered and for that, and who needs a hotel. We haven't gotten that far yet. Commissioner Allen, yes? Yes?
I think so.
Better to start with the yes.
Mm-hmm. I won't be going.
No airfare needed on that one.
Yeah, you can put me down.
Okay.
Maybe. Yes. A yes. Well, maybe.
It's better to have a room and give it back than
that's correct.
Not have a room and.
And when's that date again?
The 13th through 15. And I don't have that on the calendars because I don't have any travel information yet.
Okay.
For those.
12th, 13th of
September. Sorry. Then also in September, Commissioner Allen, 13 through 15. I'm not sure really what it is. You're going to BC? The 13th?
Oh. Power X. Power X.
Power X. Mm. Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
And then anyone besides Commissioner Smith plan to attend the water workshop towards the end of September?
And it's not in Leavenworth this year.
No. Even the website's not updated.
I'll go.
Swim.
Swim.
The sunniest place in the state.
Anyone else? I assume no eye contact means no.
No, I can't.
See, there.
Keep us on our toes, Lisa.
A word or eye contact?
Yeah.
No.
Thank you. Okay, no, and after not. That, it's October. I think that's pretty far out. So yeah. I will touch base with you then on check-in, check-out dates. And Rebecca will fill in for me starting tomorrow, and she will fill in at the next board meeting.
Have fun on your trip.
Thank you.
deserve vacation.
Again, yes, you. Enjoy.
Really? Will do. Yeah. But if I can help you with anything today or before noon tomorrow, before noon tomorrow, you okay. Let me know. Okay. Thank you.
That's good.
Done. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Lisa.
Is that all yours?
I had all mine.
Okay. Number 14. Do we have any commission items to cover?
I won't take much time. I did have a lot, but because we want to be done, I just wanted to share with you some of the things I've done, even though I wasn't here at the last meeting. I got to do a visit with the dive team at Rocky Reach, and they are so impressive. They work in such a synergistic mode. It's almost like they don't, like literally, they don't communicate verbally. They just know what to do. It's like watching synchronistic swimmers, right? But of course, being a commissioner, I'm asking questions, wanting to know about safety. And they are so thankful for all we do to make sure that they are in a safe environment. It was just like gratitude exuding from them. And it wasn't just the gratitude, it was the level of pride in what they do in their workmanship. I feel like that team is like the Navy SEAL of the PUD, you know, like the mechanics, they this is where you want to be. But I do want to credit Matt Treat, and what a treat, right? I mean, because I do think that that's a clear example of how leadership starts from the top. And like, he leads by example. He doesn't stop. That's his name, right? Treat?
Matt Treat.
Yeah.
Yep, yes. You got it right.
Like, did I get it wrong? Yeah, no, I mean, he's the Energizer Bunny, safety conscientious, and it was just a real pleasure to be there. And I guess one of the reasons I really wanted to bring this up as well is if people are listening to this, I don't think that many people in our community understand that we even have a dive team and how important it is to our maintenance and our operations of our dams. One of the questions I did ask them when I found out that we have the only team on the dive team on the Columbia is if PUDs like Douglas or Grant found themselves in a situation where they needed assistance in an emergency, would our team be willing to help out? Because as you know, we've been talking about collaboration amongst the districts. And they said, probably not. So of course I was taken back by that. And I said, why not? And they said, because of safety. You know, we don't know their dams. We don't know their maintenance. We know ours like a glove. And that really meant a lot to me at how important they take their job. And it's not just a you know, willy-nilly type situation. It's very important. They want to thank you as well for upgrading their helmets and saving them 2 pounds. Did you know they're 33 pounds? That's a heck of a lot. But I'll leave it with that. I've had a fascinating month. Oh, I'll say also I wanted to thank you for allowing me to go to the boot camp in Tacoma. It was a wonderful experience. I now feel somewhat more educated. There were 2 days that were a very high-level electrical program. So don't quiz me today, but I have to go back to my notes on the ohm law. I felt like I was back in high school. I had the good pleasure, though, of being there with Allison Bergstrom. So if you guys have not met her, I highly recommend it. She's in our risk management team, and her background is phenomenal. But you take that away, and she's just an incredible person, and I feel we're really blessed to have her at the PUD. Enough from me. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other commissioner items? That was a great report.
Thank you.
I just came back from Stehekin on personal travel, but it really was an eye-opener for me. Well, first of all, let me back up. Got to go through a tour of the generation plant up there again with my family, which was fun, and Bob did a great job. Was able to see staff that it came up on the boat that day that were working up there, maintenance, truck maintenance. I got to see a different perspective of what we do up there just on a regular day, and not people didn't know, you know, we were coming up on a tour and all that. So it was really a great day, very busy day up there. But just what I am seeing is the changes with the fire camp and that being built out by the airport and the construction that's happening in the valley. Again, my level of concern just shot up through the roof again during this last visit. It's more growth than I've seen in all the years that I've been up there. And so I'm looking forward to our September visit. I believe, Kelly, you're going to go up. And so just a great trip. Appreciated Bob and staff. And
Okay. Any other commissioner items? Follow up on delegation from previous meetings?
Yeah, we had a couple updates. One of them was an action item to gather more information on what was driving the Kaler Glen connection application to the Lake Wenatchee Wastewater Treatment Plant. And Andy Wendell sent an email on July 5th to all of you with that information. And then I had one from a prior, we were cleaning up some of these action items. I had one from way back when, and that was look for a resource to help us with governance best practices and public meetings. And that was done on April 28th. And so those are the two follow-up items, and no new ones from today.
No new ones?
Nope. Unless we missed something.
Okay. Any additional public comment? I don't see any public here, I don't believe. Are there any other matters that may necessarily come before the commission? Are we in need of an executive session today?
We are not.
That's a red letter day. Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.